When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
It's lunchtime at Tim Hortons, and we're serving up a special deal just for you. Our new $5.99 lunch deal includes your choice of any lunch sandwich and a side of crunchy kettle chips. Because what's lunch without a little crunch? And the sandwich choice is all yours. Like a ham and Swiss, Chipotle chicken wrap, BLT, and more. Made to order just the way you like it. Tim Hortons' new lunch deal. Simple, delicious, and just $5.99. Now that's a good deal. Only at your neighborhood Tim's. U.S. only. Price and participation vary. Terms apply.
Okay, motherfucker!
What are you looking at, sir?
I'm looking at you, miss.
Run that, baby.
I'm not the Zodiac. And if I was, I certainly wouldn't tell you.
Ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to One Hit Minute Productions exclusive Patreon podcast. This is our special decade project where we're going back. Anthony Lane is a terrific critic, usually for The New Yorker, and he wrote a quote that was, "You should either review a movie on the Friday that it opens or not for 50 years. Now, I'm not quite as crazy and militant as Mr. Anthony Lane is about that, but I do think that right now, increasingly, with a glut of quote-unquote content, it's really awesome to go back 10 years in our culture and actually reflect on the things that stick around. This flick that I'm talking about today is chaotic. It's about being lost in space. It's about disembodied voices. And who are your two favorite disembodied voices to listen to? They are, of course, Dan Mecca and Connor O'Donnell from the B-Side Podcast and the Film Stage. Lads, join me in space where no one can hear you scream, but they can hear us on this podcast screaming about Alfonso Cuarón's Gravity 2013.
Explorer's been hit. Explorer, do you read? Explorer, over. Explorer. Astronaut is off structure. Dr. Stone is off structure.
What do I do?
Dr. Stone, see Pat.
No.
One, see Pat. Don't attach that arm's going to carry you too far. Listen to my voice. You need to focus. I'm losing visual of you. In a few seconds, I won't be able to track you. You need to see Pat. Do you anymore. Do it now.
Where's home, Dr. Stone?
Lake Zurich, Illinois.
Is there somebody down there looking up, thinking about you?
I had a daughter. A little girl with brown hair. Tell her that I'm not quitting.
Yeah, Neil deGrasse Tyson, eat your heart out.
Hey, Neil deGrasse Tyson, stop being a dork, okay?
I've this heard, movie... I've,
I forgot about that and was just sort of doing like the cursory research.
The beginning of the bullshit with that?
Yes.
With
him, basically. And I was kind of, saw that stuff kind of pop up as I was like watching and doing research and stuff. And I immediately had that like visceral reaction again of like, shut up, nerd.
But it's also the great one. The funniest one I heard actually aptly from comedian Jerry Seinfeld. He was asking someone a question. Hey, did you see Gravity? And they're like, yeah. And he goes, the guy goes, oh, did you see all that stupid stuff about like, it's not realistic. And he goes, yeah. He goes, guess what? George Clooney's not an astronaut. Okay. he's like, what are you doing? Like, just get over it. It's George Clooney and Sandra Bullock. They're fucking astronauts. It's a cool movie.
Did you hear? I feel like Robert Downey Jr. was on Howard Stern and he talked about, because if you don't, so Gravity, what we're talking about today, initially long development of that movie. And for
Universal for a while.
It was going to be Angelina Jolie and Robert Downey Jr., right? And that fell apart kind of late. And Downey Jr. talked about it. I think it's on Stern. And he literally said, he was like, you're in these rigs in the studio, you know, and it's all green. It's all just built, you know, because it's all, you know, the whole thing is, you know, built in post. And he literally was like, I was incapable of just being stuck like in one place, trapped, unable to like move for that many hours. He's just like, it wasn't worth it. So I literally, like, he kind of confirmed, like, he just at a certain point in the testing was like, nope, that's going to be a pass. And he like, just like, and then they had to go back to the drawing board. And obviously you get Sandra Bullock and the man himself, George Clooney. But I always love that Downey Jr. confirmed. He's like, not for me, which I think is so fun.
It's an 87-minute, $100 million movie about two astronauts who are working in space to repair the Hubble telescope, played by Sandra Bullock and George Clooney. We have Ryan Stone is Sandra Bullock, funnily named because her dad wanted a boy, and Matt Kowalski, the most NASA name of any NASA-named person in the history of mankind. Directed by one of my favorite filmmakers, Alfonso Cuarón. It made a stack of money. It had Oscar nominations out the wazoo. And when I went back to watch it in preparation for you guys, I realized that this is one of those rare ones that I had been keeping sacred, because I saw it in a small Sydney theaterette screening like 10 years ago. And I was so blown away by the cinema experience and like literally, you know, white knuckling on the sides of my seat watching this movie and feeling such a relief to actually, just like Sandra Bullock, walk out of the water at the end of this movie, that I hadn't watched it again. And I just marveled at like, oh my God, our friend Jordan Harper, mutual friend, tight 90 is his phrase about a movie that is under 90 minutes. It's 87 minutes with credits. This is so special. So, so special.
And feels like a thing that almost will never happen again.
Never happen again.
Well, like, I don't know. I was thinking about that while I was rewatching it today.
Nobody will make this kind of movie. It's more like for the specific metrics you mentioned, Blake. Like, if someone's making this movie, they're making it for like less money, or way more money to achieve a similar result.
Like, yeah, they're going 200 million and the runtime must be 3 hours. And the actors will not be as good. Or you're making a tight 90, hugely, you know, it's all about the expression of bodies in motion and action. It's like a pure action movie of like everything is in the action. There's not a lot of exposition. There's not really any explanation. It's such a masterstroke in establishing what the movie is, establishing what I guess the problem is with this, you know, this Russian satellite that's been blown up by a missile and then turns into this, you know, kind of tornado of carnage that's circling the orbit of the Earth and is just taking out satellites and space stations, you know, with no care. It's nothing. It's just a perilous cloud of death that's going around the Earth. And you don't get monstrous actors who are basically on screen the entire time in a variety of different awesome Dutch angled close-ups. It's just not going to happen. You're going to get Sydney Sweeney and Timothy Chalamet, Jacob Elordi, or whatever his name is. They're going to spend $900 million on Netflix, and it's going to be awful. And we know this. This is, if I'm talking about the Decade Project, it's like we'll eventually get to kind of our lessons, or could it be made again, or what have we learned? But man, it took me
back. I don't disagree with any of that. I think that's, yeah. I guess what I was getting at, I think it's a great, more than anything else, it's a great screenplay, and you could really teach to a class, forget about realism, whatever. I literally, as like an entertainment delivery system, and also an empathy, machine, right? To reference the famous quote, obviously by Roger Ebert, but and I believe, what is it? Caron and his son wrote it, right? So it's like, it's literally just a movie where, to your point, 10 minutes in, it's like, here's where we are. Here are the stakes, right? And then along the way, you kind of deepen the stakes by breathing in the characters a little bit more. And then, it's kind of beautiful at the, and I think the movie got criticized for this, but I think it's actually kind of beautiful. Like at these moments where the movie has these narrative corners it writes itself into, they write themselves out of it. And I think it's very clever. And I think I understand the criticisms of it, the George Clooney character coming back an hour in, and he's just kind of, he's obviously like a figment of her panicked survival brain. I love it. I don't know that I loved it when I saw it, but I love it now. I feel like I watched it a few months ago because it was on Max, and then now I watched it yesterday or today, and what a great piece of entertainment. I feel like that's such a high compliment. It's like you can't really overstate, just to your point, like you said, Blake, like when I saw this in the theaters, right, when she stands up at the end, you exhale. Right. Yes.
You're like, oh my God, been on 2%. I've been on 2% oxygen for like 60 minutes. But,
can I tell you? So this is interesting. I was thinking about this today, and Connor, I know you, I think we'll all relate to this. And I was actually listening to, as part of this Decade Project, I was listening to your episode about Prisoners, which I also rewatched because I was loving listening to the episode. And what I think, and we talk about this a lot on our podcast, what I like probably more than anything is just the in Gravity and in Prisoners, but in Gravity, and they're both like silly movies, right? Whatever. Yeah. But like, what I love is it so deftly articulates process, right? Like in my job, in Connor's job, Blake, I presume in your kind of many, many jobs, like, process, production, right? Like organization, application, like it sounds so boring. But like in a movie like Gravity, all of that stuff, like Matt Kowalski saying to Ryan Stone, like, okay, you're at 2%. Don't panic, right? 1%. Okay. There's so many great moments. Like, okay, you're out of oxygen. And like your viewer's mind is like, she's fucked. And then it's like, well, okay, you have oxygen in your suit, right? There's always just how are you going to get through this thing? And, you're on a $200,000 commercial set. We're missing this thing. Okay. We're missing this thing. Okay. Like, this ass came in from talent that was never anticipated. Okay. Well, how are we going to handle it? Right. Like, and then let's deal with the next thing. Right?
It threads through just the efficient nature of solving the problem that's right in front of you. And
problem solving. Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
And it's something that, for instance, I don't want to get into a debate of which movie does it better, but it's a similar ethos to something like The Martian, right? Where literally they they say that out loud at the end, basically, right? Like Matt Damon's talking to people and he's
that's more of a Neil deGrasse Tyson movie. I'm going to science the shit out of this.
I love Ridley, and I like that movie, and it's very entertaining.
No, it's a good movie. Yeah.
But it's kind of making it text, right? And but it's the same exact ethos here of like, look, you solve the thing that's right in front of you, and then you solve the next thing and the next thing and the next thing, which is the other, like, who among us, whether it's a friend or
why are escape rooms popular?
Well, right. No, no, no. Yeah. And it's
I mean, seriously, that's why. That's why.
Yeah, yeah. No, it's exactly that.
Wait. Did we just discover that Alfonso Cuarón's gravity
is an escape room?
Is the reason that escape rooms exist?
Honestly, if there's an amusement park out there that could figure out some sort of ride that is basically a virtual astronaut escape room, you've got my money, is all I'm gonna say. But basically, like, there's something both panic inducing and soothing about this movie, right? In a way that feels like somebody comforting you, right? Whether it's like, because, you know, whatever, we've all been there, like either talking with or to like somebody who's either having a panic attack or just having a bad moment or whatever, and you just do like the, hey, like, okay, what's the problem, what's the thing, right? You know, and it's like that whole thing of like, you just take the macrocosm and you make microcosm until you're picking away at it, and then you're home free, right? And I don't know, it's something this movie captures so easily. I remember the other thing this movie got kind of shit for when it came out, and I understand it, but I also think it's sort of, you're sort of not realizing the value of the thing when you do it, which is like, you know, it got kind of dogged for like it's very overt visual symbolism and things like that. And like, I understand that. My ethos with that stuff is always like, if your movie is 90 minutes or less, you get to do that, right? Like, you get to be totally overt with your metaphors, and you get to be really on the nose because you are operating, you know, you're operating within a specific time frame.
I'm like, if you don't like visual symbolism, listen to the fucking radio. Okay. Don't watch movies. I don't want a boring straight down the line. Like, and that's the thing, if we're talking about, and let me put it this out of the record. I love Ridley Scott. Many of his movies, as a pure aesthete, I love him. Many of his movies, hugely entertaining. The three of us talked about Gladiator, a movie that is exactly rated, not under or over,
has a perfect reputation.
It has a perfect reputation for exactly what it is, and is great. And so I love him. But that's the reason why I don't love as much The Martian, is because in this movie, those overwhelming moments of panic and the isolation and that kind of what we've typically called like space madness movies,
sure,
you know, originating all the way back to the first, you know, 1950s sci-fi movies where people go mad in some kind of space exploration. You know, even as far back as like Forbidden Planet, you got a little like started getting hints of that. But that's what I love about this movie, because that isolation and that panic and that human connection are the things that sometimes tether you to not just fucking losing your mind. And even if it's an imagination, an imaginary moment of a Matt Kowalski coming back in to kind of recenter the things and like pluck things out of your deepest recesses of your memory, I kind of love that. Whereas I just felt like it was like, here's the process, here we go. Like a little bit of The Martian. And it didn't connect with me. Whereas this, I'm like, you know, to your point before, Dan, okay, right now your oxygen's low. It's not beer, it's wine. Sip it slowly. Just those little things are so great. And it's funny, in every job, I remember I was doing customer service one time, and I was dealing with a customer complaint, and they were so mad, and we were talking for a long time. And after a while, they were getting really, there was no de-escalation. And I just paused, and I just sort of like thought, and I had this like epiphany, and I went, hey, can you just do me something? I know this is a really strange ask. Can you paint me a picture of what is going to make you happy at the end of this conversation? Just like pretend that there's nothing that I can't do. Just paint me a picture of what's going to make you happy. And after that, after a massive pregnant pause, the person like said, I want to be reimbursed for my time, and I want this, you know, fee that I don't agree with to be refunded. And I go, how much is your time worth? And they had to answer like, oh, like, I don't know, like $100 an hour. And I go, okay. And I made a calculation and I refunded them. And I go, it's done. And they go, okay. And I go, okay. Like, it was just that thing of like, this movie does that for me. It's like, what is the thing exactly as you were talking about before, Dan, and you, Connor, is like, what is the thing? What is the actual problem that is in front of your face right now? Can you articulate it? And if there's no problem, if you can't articulate it, there's no problem. But it will appear to you, what is the immediate thing that I need to resolve right now and then move to the next challenge? Because that's life. Like, that's what it is. What's the immediate problem? How do I solve it? Okay, cool. Let's move on to the next thing. And there might be a line of these problems, as is so wonderfully articulated in this movie. There might be a line of them, but that's okay. We're just going to
do it. It's why space movies and perhaps underwater movies to a lesser extent, right? They work so well in that space when you think about it, because they're kind of like blank canvases a little bit, right? It's like, if you can take your characters and put them into a situation that feels extraordinary for like 99% or 100% of everybody watching, you can kind of get to the core of what matters, right? Yeah. Like, as opposed to, you know, if you're doing a Prisoners, right, to reference a recent subject, or like anything like that, and you're on Earth and you're in a small town, and it's like the complexity almost becomes front and center.
Yes.
More often, because it's like, well, you get it. Right. And it's like, that's not saying that's any worse. It's literally just saying, I think when you think about Interstellar, The Martian to a lesser degree, The Abyss, the Avatar movies, which take place in a whole nother world, obviously, but like, these are simple, simple narratives, right? Yes. All of them.
Yes.
But the reason they work so well, I mean, literally every James Cameron movie, right? I mean, even the ones that are on Earth, right? That's his genius is literally stripping everything down and convincing you he hasn't, right? Of course. But that's the beauty of these movies, because you're just like, okay, we're in space. Wow, that's nuts.
Right.
What next? Yeah. Right. So I think, Kuran, and look, to a degree, Kuran's kind of, it's interesting. His career is almost like it's almost been a hem and a haw of those two things, right? It's like A Little Princess is a little bit like that. Great Expectations, you would argue, considered his greatest failure, in my opinion, his greatest masterwork, but like is both at the same time, which people really had a problem with. And then like the Harry Potter movie is very much that, but then Y tu Mama Tambien, right? It's like he's not everybody can do that, right? I think he's kind of a very special filmmaker in that way.
And I think what you're getting at that's so distinct and helps this movie so specifically is point of view, right? Is like a decision to concretely, in some of the things you just mentioned, either look at the world from the outside in or look at it from the inside out, right? Yeah. And like deciding which thing you're going to rope the audience in with. And obviously, he goes inside out here, right? Because it's all, basically Sandra Bullock. Yeah.
Yeah. It's like, what's she dealing with? Yeah.
And it's like immensely helpful, because it's just the minute you go from outside in, it's The Martian, right? And you have to explain, like, how does the thing work? Okay, here's how the thing works. And there's, to your point, Dan, nothing necessarily wrong.
No, I love that too.
It's just a different way of watching the movie. And I think what's so genius about this movie is how it brings you, the viewer, coming in cold, presumably, right? Coming in cold, it brings you to a place of emotionality from logic, while it brings its character from a place of emotionality to logic.
Yes.
Right. And that's the beauty, right? Is this like inverted relationship you've got with Ryan Stone, where like you're coming in and you're like, all right, what's the business here? And then they kind of give you the business, right? You got, you got Ed Harris chatting to you about just the
masterstroke choice of
beautiful casting, obviously.
Oh, sure. Nice little homage.
Who else would you trust more to get you back from space? Well, right.
And look, a great example of the opposite. Ron Howard, maybe there are few people better at doing The Martian than Ron Howard.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah,
sure.
13 Lives, Apollo 13, Rush.
Competency porn.
Love it. Right.
Yeah.
But I was going to say,
Shout out to all you Rush heads out there. Okay, from
Rush, like Rush fucking rules.
No, Rush ruled. No.
Oh, Rush rules. Yeah.
I'm like, shout out. Not enough props for Rush. And also to my real Frost Nixon gang. A fucking movie is Frost Nixon.
I do kind of like, I kind of,
you
like
know, Frost actually, Nixon, you know who's the fucking best in Frost Nixon?
Kevin Bacon.
Yeah. So yeah. Absolutely. Kevin Bacon. Kevin,
and
all timer performance.
Oliver Platt, if you just want him to come in and crush every scene and make everyone look like a dope just around him because he's just amazing. Yeah. Shout out to our Rush heads. Shout out to our Frost Nixon heads out there.
And so I like talking about the movie this way because I love that customer service story because I think me and my wife talk about this. And as parents, Blake, you and I, right? Yeah. I'm sure you'll relate to this. And Connor, I mean, obviously.
No, I mean, it's probably the same way you would calm down a child, right? Yeah. It's the similar.
Well, what I was going to say is, I think what's interesting is, right? I think partly because of my day job, whatever, right? I have a tendency when things get really bad I get very calm.
Me too.
Right? Like
people don't, when it goes
going really bad. Right. And I think this just is from my life. And I'm not like, I've lived a blessed life. I'm saying literally like just working on sets, dealing with,
there were those 5 years your mom locked you in the basement.
That's true. That's la, 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 la,
la, la, la, la, la, la, la.
Love you, mom. No, but literally like, speaking of prisoners, so
that's what I was trying.
I know it was coming. But my point is, there's a perverse comfort in those moments for me.
Yeah,
that I'm grateful for. Of like, okay, like the kid just fell or whatever the thing that happens, right? And it's like, I tend thankfully, okay. Like, what do we need to do right now? Right. And I think
my daughter broke her leg last year.
Mm.
She's jumping on a trampoline, broke her leg.
Nightmare.
And awful thing, worst thing ever. Trampolines suck. No matter how many times dad told her, don't jump on a trampoline with a ball on there. It happened. Yeah. And when it happened, I heard her scream. My wife and I ran out of the house and was like, okay. And I looked at her. I'm like, her leg's broken. And she sat down and I said, baby, daddy's going to put a 10-minute timer on his watch. And if you can't put your leg on the floor and stand on it, I'm taking you to the hospital.
Right.
Yeah. And then she couldn't stand on it. And you just do it and you're going through the motions and you're being super calm. And then a couple of times in the hospital, they're like, hey, leg, we don't think it's broken. And I said, listen to me.
Yeah.
I've never heard that child scream like that. And she stacked it a lot. She's unco, like her dad. I'm like, it's broken. So you're going to do an x-ray. You're going to find out it's broken or you're not. Yeah. And I'm going to take her home and then I'm going to take you to an x-ray tomorrow. And then you're going to look like an idiot. So you're going to just give her the x-ray and you're going to do it. And they did it. Of course it's broken. It's such, I think you just figure out, okay, what's the plan? We're going to figure out the plan. Then that's the thing.
Yeah. So that's what I'm saying. The comfort comes from like every single thing goes wrong, right, in the movie. And then the rest of the movies is like, okay, you just got to get home. All right. So how are you going to do that? Right. And I think it's so comforting as well as very stressful because it's like, there is a universal relatability, you know, like you said, Blake, any job does not matter. Right. I was a waiter forever. Right. The eggs are wrong. Okay. The eggs are wrong. All right. I'll fix the eggs. Right. You know, like whatever, right. Whatever, you know, whatever the situation is, you learn in that moment. You know, to just, you know, steady your mind and deal with the problem. And I think the movie really encapsulates that really well. And I think, look, I mean, maybe to pivot to Sandra Bullock for a second, I think it works that perhaps the most relatable movie star who's ever lived is playing the lead role. Yeah.
That's true of both of them, I think, right? It's certainly great. It's amazing. It's amazing casting because you're in already. You're like, I like both of you.
And Angelina Jolie, for example, had she gotten the role, I don't know. I mean, it would have been a different movie, but it's like, you know what it reminds me of? That Max movie that she made, the Warner Brothers movie, Those Who Wish Me Dead.
Which I kind of like.
I like the film.
Yeah.
But it's like, I think a good example of if Sandra Bullock was the lead of that movie, I bet you it probably would have performed a little better because I just think Angelina Jolie is like so exceptional. Like
she's like, got the Russell Crowe thing. She does.
Sure. Yes. She
does. Yeah, a little bit. Yeah. A little bit. Which just for the listeners, Blake came
no,
on.
No, don't tell them. Just listen to the Russell.
Listen
Crowe
to the Russell Crowe B-side podcast. Where for the first time I stumped Dan Mecca, which I'm so proud of. And Connor actually has done it to me on this one, which is you synthesize what it is for me about Alfonso Cuarón. Every one of his films are about inside out. Right. Every single film is about that. That's what he nailed about the Harry Potter franchise. This is called
exactly right.
Harry Potter and whatever, right? It's about this kid. You have to go through him to see the world. So I don't give a shit about the world. Then, like, Children of Men.
You remember people were so mad that because he took the uniform. What they're like, not wearing uniforms.
He put them in Gap clothes, basically.
People are mad, so mad about everything in those movies, and then now they're like the best thing ever. It's like the Star Wars prequel kids, you know? Like, it's just, they're so happy with them. They yell quote them. I see them on Instagram and Twitter all the time. I'm like, good for
you. That's the funniest thing. I say this all the time. My brother is that kid because my brother is 10 years younger than me.
Yeah.
So like, he loves the prequel movies because of course, and it's like, but of course he does. Because he was a kid. They're for kids. I don't want to offend anybody, but they're for kids. Like, you can like them and be 45. It's fine. I'm just saying.
Speaking of B-sides, when we were kids, the Caravan of Courage movies came out, like the Caravan of Courage and the other Ewok adventure movie. I don't even remember what it was. Anyway, after many, many, many years, I got a DVD of Caravan of Courage. Like, I'm talking like 15 years ago. And I'd watched it 10,000 times on like Betamax tape at my house. And I watched this movie and then there was a narrator and I go, this narrator? I've watched it so many times as a kid that I didn't even register that it had a narration to explain to me, a child at the time, what was actually happening in this world. And I'm like, a narrator. Wow. Interesting choice. But that's how you view things. But no, I think that's the thing of like these Alfonso Cuarón movies are from inside out. It's everything that's happened. And that's in Roma. It's about the inside. Right. It's the tiny microcosmic family. And then the outside world is all of these other forces that are going on. And they're there. They're rendered so beautifully, but they don't need to be foregrounded in his movies. And in the best movies, they're not. It's all about individuals. It's all about these people. It's all about these tight-knit relationships. And even Children of Men with all the forces in that movie, which is, you know, in some ways on a micro scale, just about a guy trying to rescue a refugee girl. And on a macro scale, it's about the death of the human race. And so like, you know, all those things are beautifully rendered, but he just does it here. And same with here, it's the entire, you know, it's the entire world. It's the entire, you know, infrastructure of space exploration and human endeavor. But it's really just like, I just need to get home.
Look, to Connor's earlier point, Is there a more beautiful shot in the movie, like even rewatching it today, where like she's telling a story about how her kid died and it's like her face and the whole world are in the shot?
Yes. Yes.
And it's like, that's beautiful. That's like a painting. Cause it's like, it's punching you in the face. The symbolism fine, but who cares? It's like,
I like symbolism to punch me in the face. I don't want subtlety. If you want subtlety, get out of here. I don't want it.
But you know what kills me? Not to get petty, but let's just go there. Whatever. It's Thursday night, like slash Friday morning.
Friday
like,
morning, baby. I'm on the weekend already. I know. Here we go.
But like the same people who criticize, you know, that about Gravity love Dogville. You know what I'm saying? which I love Dogville. Okay. But I'm saying, like, nobody's more hitting you in the face, you know, than so many of these, like, you know, cinephile approved filmmakers and films.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah.
But it's because, like, you know, the budgets are lower, or, you know, there's a stage instead of a
Lars
you know
could
I mean?
Only
it's
afford like, a soundstage and some chalk instead of buildings and some cruddy costumes. Right. And that's enough. And I'm like, yeah, well, that's why this movie. If there's a difference between then and now, that's where we can reflect and go, that's why it's unusual, because he got $100 million. Probably 30 to 40 million of that was on just Clooney and Bullock.
Probably.
60 million is the production. And
absolutely.
That's, you know, they got $100 million. It made stack of money. It was award nominated at the Wazoo. Like, I mean, if that's what's that's why now you look at it and you're like, oh, you can make really carefully curated, highly dependent on special effects movies that don't suck, but they can't be in a factory line of, we are part of a series, we are using the same warehouses of all these really tirelessly, you know, passionate artists who are often overworked, doing like 70-hour working weeks and all that shit.
I had said this the other day, and again, to Dan's point, like, whatever, let's be petty. But like, so I finally saw that fucking Spider-Verse movie, and I feel like I'm in the minority because I like really did not enjoy myself.
Oh, I'm sad to hear that. I enjoyed myself, and my daughter, just so you know, Connor, in the actual crescendo of the movie, the chase that happens,
sure,
my daughter needed to go to the toilet, so I missed basically the finale of the movie, and her younger brother was there with my friend, and I'm like, dude, do you need to go to the toilet? He's like, no. Like, he's like, no, I'm that Spider-Man.
I'm watching this. I'm watching this.
I
will pee in my seat. And I'm like, yeah, cool. Your sister is actually going to pee in her seat. So I'm taking
it. And look, I'm not trying to take it from anybody. But it's, I found myself kind of, and it's not really the fault of the movie. And clearly a lot of great work went into that movie, right? It's on the screen for sure. But I had myself thinking like, yeah, but like, we used to put all of this talent in service of like other things. And like, I didn't think this at the time, but I'm like realizing it now, like the kinds of things I was talking about are Gravity, right? Yeah. It's like, yeah, like we used to put, to your point, just the level of care and curation, like, or quaration, if you want.
Quaration.
Hey now.
But you know, that level of focus and attention to detail.
You say
and
things.
Stuff,
you say things like that, Connor, and I think of whole podcast series in 4 seconds, right? That's what I think of.
You DM me later. We'll figure it out. But yeah, it's, I don't know. It's all to say, just, yeah, there's a level of care to this movie that's apparent on every single corner of the frame.
Yes.
And you don't,
and also like the comfort that there, it's Gravity. There's no Gravity 2. There's no Gravity 3.
Yes, exactly. Yeah.
Right?
Exactly.
It's
and like, it's, you know, just its own little piece of entertainment that just sits there for you to be able to watch, which
80 minutes. So many people, let's stay in the petty lane before we move on. So many people are like, dude, you got to watch this show. Swear to God, it's like 24 episodes a season and 42 minutes an episode. I'm like, two episodes. You're like, oh, really warms up in season 3. Wait, so I got to watch 48 episodes of this shit before it warms up? I got 80 minutes of Gravity. It's in and out. It's a fucking treat.
That's why I let Brittany watch the TV shows. And then like, and if the zeitgeist really holds on to something, then I'm like, okay, I'll watch it.
Wait, my friend the other day goes, how do you watch so many movies? I go, I don't watch TV. And he's like,
I watch
a shitload of terrible TV. Okay. Yeah, I know. Like, you tell me you should watch the show. I'm like, no, I'm not doing it. It's not happening.
And it's okay if people listening, if you like your TV and your shows.
I'll show the boys here. This is the test disc stack for the next Imprint Companion that just came in the mail. There's
I was going to ask. You're always watching
movies. For the listener, Blake just held up what appears to be about a 2-inch thick envelope stack of discs.
16 movies are just the next batch. And it's like, I'm not watching a TV show, guys. I got films to watch. You can have your show. You can watch The Idol. I'm going back to Walter Hill's Extreme Prejudice on Blu-ray. That's what I'm doing.
Hello. Yeah, I gotta rewatch that movie, actually.
It's a good one. But so
you know what Walter those Hill, what I'll just to bring it back, what I will recommend to those people if they want something a little shorter, Gravity.
Yeah. You get 80 minutes.
Bang it out.
Yeah, you knock it out and like you feel like it's not even an hour and you're like, oh God, this is so fast. So this is in the show, like we kind of started then what the reaction was. I feel like we've covered that. We absolutely talked about, I think now in sort of our pettiness, I think it's pretty clear that movies like this don't exist. But I want to usually ask kind of what we've learned. And I just want to say, I think the thing that I learn increasingly is what a treasure Alfonso Cuarón is as a filmmaker. He's just a treasure. Whenever I revisit any of his films, he's one of those guys who, perhaps because he's just out of that kind of, you know, he's not like a filmmaker who sort of talks and has been mythologized as much. He's absolutely in the, you know, the Three Musketeers are Iñárritu, Guillermo del Toro, and Alfonso Cuarón, and they've all won Best Director at the Oscars, and they've all, you know, and all three of the guys call Michael Mann Uncle Mike, so of course they're my kind of guys. And I look at him and I go, what a career he has had. What a career.
And he's not that prolific.
Not
either,
prolific,
which I think is part of the secret sauce to what you're talking about a little bit. Like, it I think that both helps and hurts it, right? Like, I think he's a little more prolific, because he's even less prolific than, say, like a Nolan, right? Who is, I guess you could call prolific, but like kind of barely at the rate that some other filmmakers make movies, right? So like,
well, like even PTA, 9 movies, man. He has a whole mythology, and you look at I'm just going to Cuarón as a director.
Yeah, he's directed.
He's like 10, right?
He's got Roma, Gravity,
9 movies,
Children of Men,
or no, 8 movies.
Harry Potter, Itamama. Well,
so Solo con tu Paria, right? Is his first feature. Little Princess, Great Expectations, Itamama, Harry Potter, Children of Men, Gravity, Roma.
Yeah, four, five, eight. You know what that is, though? It's a really good batting average.
Oh my gosh. That's like, is it what?
It's like,
is it what?
Yeah. I mean, it speaks to, well, look, I think to kind of to what we're talking about, he handles it all with a certain amount of care. And I think that can't get overstated. And I think, you know, Iñárritu is obviously, I think, a little bit more polarizing, but you could say the same thing about him, whether or not you like his films. I think there's certainly, you know, the works on the screen. And I think he's made, I think, 7 movies, and it's like, that speaks a lot to kind of, you know, him as well. And Del Toro, of course, right? Obviously. And yeah, I think it's just interesting how they have just become like these very rare gems. And I think there's so little middle ground.
Yeah.
In terms of what we're talking about, right? Like, and this is a constant talking point, but like, you know, Jonathan Mostow does not exist anymore, right? A guy who's making Breakdown, U571, right? Whatever.
I mean,
right?
All those people direct TV now, right? That's the thing.
Sure, sure. And I'm saying, you know, that world of like capable, you know, storytellers, right? Who get things in on time and under budget. They exist, but yeah, they're, you know, the Carl Franklin's, like, he directs TV, right? It's like, you know, and I think,
God, what you wouldn't have given for Carl Franklin to make 25 Devil in a Blue Dress sequels. Right. You know,
I still hold out hope for like one more Franklin Denzel Washington movie, because it could happen. Sure. I mean, you know, sure. Just, you know, they did Out of Time. I underrated. I love it.
Is there an Easy Rollins novel where he's just older?
Can you just change it
anyway. Yeah, why not? They did it with Marlo, you know. Liam Neeson gets to play Marlo. Let's do that for Devil in a Blue Dress.
That's a good idea.
I think in terms of like the then and now, what's interesting is I feel like as big as this movie felt at the time, you never hear people talk about this
movie.
Doesn't
have a footprint. Doesn't have a
footprint. I guess to your point, Blake, about like maybe you also, there's not really as much mythologizing around Cuarón in general. And maybe if there was, people would talk about it more.
Yeah.
So you don't really hear people talk about this. I rewatched this for the first time in years. I think probably since I like bought the Blu-ray in like 2014, right? I rewatched it for the first time when we were prepping for our Sandra Bullock B-side episode, because I hadn't seen it in a while, and that was like an amazing experience, because it was like, oh yeah, why don't I watch this more? Like, this thing is just a banger. And like, it just, I'm trying to think of like a comparable movie that maybe has the same, you know, internet love, zeitgeisty love, and I don't know if I can really think of one.
I've got one for you. The Gray. Yeah.
Sure. Like, yeah, like just something that like people latch on to.
You watch it, it's unrelenting, it's philosophical,
mm-hmm.
and the peril is nature. And I think that that's a perfect double feature of Gravity and The Grey, because they're just like, both start with GR if you're sticking to the GRs in your alphabetized Blu-ray collection. And it's yeah, they're kind of both there, but that's the thing. It's not in the zeitgeist like it was. It was such a zeitgeist movie, but I don't know. It just, maybe it's a bit of an indictment of like our current idea of what cinema is. Like, there's a great conversation between Brian Koppelman on his podcast and Chris McQuarrie, and they're talking
I was waiting for you to bring him up, because we were talking about like workman guys, and I feel like McQuarrie,
he's that kind
like
of guy.
He's like Koppelman. The last one. But
they're both those guys, but it's like, they're like, there's a time where, and they were quoting a Mamet quote of like, cinema and storytelling were not necessarily intrinsically connected. And sometimes they are. And like right now they are, like cinema is story. So and now story is kind of largely television. So like when we're watching big cinema things, they're trying to take some of like, eat some of TV's lunch, if you like, and go, we have to tell these serialized stories. And that's how you have footprint, and that's how you have IP and all that sort of stuff. And so right now the current paradigm is that movies have to be stories, and they can't be allegorical, and they can't be abstract. They have to be, just tell me a story. And I think that there are great cinematic storytellers that that can work, but they just don't, they want to tell, you know, I guess in the grandest scheme, they want to tell a short story. They want to tell a short story that's punchy, that's loaded with information, loaded with feeling, and it doesn't have to be 12 movies long before they get their point out or clear their throat. It's just this thing that is succinct and concise. And so yeah, it's really fascinating that this is the kind of guy that can do this, and this movie had such a massive footprint and a massive impact at the time, and definitely helped to push technology that we're still using today. But it doesn't, amongst his oeuvre, it doesn't seem to like register a blip, and it doesn't seem to register for Bullock either. And I would argue this is vastly better than a lot of movies that people like rave that Sandy Bullock is in, you know, like she's phenomenal in this movie.
She's, and we kind of talked about this on our B-side episode about her a little bit, but the weird, and it's going to sound like an insult, and I guess it is, but I kind of mean it as a compliment. But the thing with her that I think, I kind of don't think I realized until we did that episode, and maybe other people haven't either, is that like, for as big of a movie star as she has a surprisingly awful batting average in terms of like the projects. And it's kind of shocking when you think about it, right? Because like, she's one of our biggest, right, ever. And so it is weird to like look at her filmography and see that it all comes, Dan and I were just talking about this off mic earlier, that like she has these like banner years. And there and then, but there's like a lot of in between where you're like, whoa, wow.
Well,
like,
yeah, I mean, literally like 93 to 95, right? Speed, While You Were Sleeping. She's in like five movies in 93. And then there's kind of a lot of the movies don't hit. You know, a lot of people love Practical Magic, but it wasn't a hit. Hope Floats, I like it, wasn't a hit, really.
Love Practical Magic, by the way. Love that.
Yeah.
An absolutely insane movie.
But Hope Floats does okay, doesn't do great, right? Forces of Nature, rom-com with Ben Affleck, does okay, doesn't do great. Not a great movie, but then it's like 2000, Miss Congeniality, 2002, 2 Weeks Notice, rom-com queen again.
Yeah.
But then it's like another period of like movies don't really work.
And then the Miss Congeniality too is ghastly.
Right, that didn't work. The Lake House, nobody really sees, even though I think that's kind of a great movie. And then 2009 is the like big comeback, The Proposal, and this movie, or no, the before this movie, it's The Proposal Blindside.
Yeah.
Huge hit. She wins an Oscar. And then she doesn't do much for 4 years. Makes, you know, she has a supporting role in Extremely Loud. And then 2013 is The Heat and Gravity, which are huge. Gets another Oscar nomination. And then, like, disappears again. And then comes back 2018, Bird Box, Netflix's biggest movie at the time. Plus Ocean's 8, and then she's gone, and then she comes back with The Lost City, and now she's, you know, semi-retired.
Lost City is fun.
It's fun. I like that movie. So, but the point is, a lot of those movies I named aren't necessarily even great. I'm just saying, it's like, Connor's right. You can really pick, like, you know, your Gravities are really, there aren't a lot of Gravities in her CV, you know, and I think she's often better than her movies.
Yes.
And I think gravity is a moment where the movie matches, you know, the actress.
Yeah.
I would almost argue like maybe it's like in that run that we're talking about, it's literally like speed and like and Miss Congeniality.
Yeah.
Are like the other two moments where that it seems
truly the movie, the zeitgeist, everything about it. Like I could watch Miss Congeniality like that. Like it's such a fun movie and she's excellent in it. Gravity, absolutely. Speed, any day of the week. Shout out to Chris Tapley's terrific 50 miles an hour speed podcast, the Oral History of Speed, which is currently available, but it's like so good. And then like the other one, you have to give her props, Demolition Man. She's so wonderful in Demolition Man.
I just don't think of that as like a Sandra Bullock vehicle in any capacity, but
so good.
She's just one of those movie stars. I mean, look, Meryl Streep, I think sometimes unfairly gets that criticism where like her performances often outshine the movies. I think that's a little reductive because she actually has made a lot of incredible films. But like, I also think there's a thing about just like, you know, this happened to Brad Pitt for a long time. It's like, sometimes you're bigger than the thing you're in. Right. So I think that's not necessarily the fault of the actor.
Some actors, and this is why people praise The Living Daylights out of like Leo. And it's been validated on lots of different podcasts and stuff like that and lots of different reporting. It's like that Leo has like a rule in his contract that he works with basically three directors, like as a standing. And those three directors.
After Titanic, right? Yeah.
But those three directors are Quentin Tarantino, Martin Scorsese, and Spielberg are like the three that, I'll work with all those guys. And like, there's others that do pop into his resume very rarely, but it's like, my first look is to work with these guys. And
well,
that's
like, what, remember, I mean, Macquarie, he talks about that, right? He wrote an Alexander the Great script that ultimately didn't get made, but ultimately because Oliver Stone made his fine, but there was kind of an arms race of two Alexander the Great movies and
at the time, but I think Oliver Stone's one killed five others. So.
Sure. But Macquarie's was really going, but I think one of the early death blows was Macquarie insisted on directing it for a long time and Leo was attached and it was literally like, well, Leo's not going to let you direct him because he only wants to work with Spielberg.
Well, and then Oliver Stone wept because there were no more Alexander the Great movies.
No, exactly. I want to talk about favorite.
Very educated joke. Very funny.
It was wonderful.
That's for people who paid attention in ninth grade history class.
Yeah.
No one paid attention in ninth grade.
That's what I'm saying. It's like five people. Hi,
Connor and the other four.
Honey, they made an Alexander the Great joke. I'm gonna pause it. Come back. Come. Okay, are you listening? Okay. I'm gonna press play. Okay.
We talked about the hallucination moment. Stunning moment in the movie.
It is a great moment.
And according to the interwebs, Kowalski coming back was Clooney's idea.
Is that right?
Yeah, he says that Karan and his son, who wrote the film,
Jonas, were
never quite totally satisfied with just Kowalski's float off into space. The despairing thought of him going away. And Clooney said they weren't happy with the resolution. And so they tried to do a bunch of revisions and they removed dialogue and they added dialogue. And then Clooney had a crack at like writing the scene, like how the scene would play out. And apparently that's what we see in the movie. That hallucination space pod scene is a Clooney scene.
It's funny because there's another
collaborative medium, you know,
there's another
reason I love it.
There's a contingent of people, on the internet or whatever. And I don't know if people still think this now, but I remember at the time there was a whole contingent of people who were like, well, you know, she really dies in the end. Right. It's like that kind of thing. And that to me is like so willfully ignoring the preceding 80 minutes. You know what I mean? Like, you're just kind of like, that is not
the thing. Like, I understand the lot, like that this scene is the scene that people use as the sort of cornerstone of that argument.
This is the same impulse, but taken down a different rabbit hole of the Neil deGrasse Tyson.
It's not real. So what's it?
It's like this is a movie. It's such a strange thing. Cause it's like,
if you want the science, go to a library. I don't care. Exactly. Like, do whatever you want.
People's brains go there because they need a way to square the weird circle that is this scene that pops up. Right. Like, and I think, I don't know, to me it feels so in the spirit of the whole movie. Like, I don't, like, especially where it decides to take you, because like I was saying before, like, it takes you from a place of logic into a place of emotion. And yeah, maybe Matt Kowalski showing up and opening the door to the fucking pod and getting in and talking to her, yes, maybe that obviously makes no sense logically, but it makes perfect sense emotionally, and that's why it has to happen. Like, and I think, I don't know, to me it's almost like, not only is it just nice because Clooney's charming and they have excellent chemistry, by the way,
excellent.
It's like, it's the kind of scene that you're sort of like, shit, why the fuck have they not gotten their own, like, out of sight or whatever? Like, why, how is,
what's
this
that, what's that,
like,
George Clooney, Julia Roberts movie? I want to,
Trouble in Paradise.
Ticket to Paradise.
Trouble in Paradise, a great Ernst Lubitsch film, I believe, but Ticket to Paradise.
Different picture.
Is
different
an picture. Okay, I believe his name's Ol Parker film.
yeah, but that sort of thing where you're just watching movie stars charm the living pants off of you for an hour and you're just happy. You're
exactly.
Like, okay, I'm happy.
And I'm not going to, I guess I'm just not going to get mad at that in this movie if they decide to give it to me for a second. Like, I don't know why you would, unless you're parties. At least. Look.
So also, we talked about Robert Downey Jr. I just want to talk about this. What if Marianne Cotillard screen tested for the part, but went on to go and work with Christopher Nolan in Inception, and Portman screen
is that
tested.
Your little car? Just because we said her name, I had to do it.
I had to tell you that because I wanted the dance.
You gotta watch it. Is that your little car? listen to that.
I'm still waiting for the After Effects from Connor to do that. Is that your
little car? Oh, I got it. Okay.
Yeah. Is that your little car?
Because you reminded me, Blake. I'll do it tonight.
Yes.
The crowd cheered. I think so. You mentioned Portman. I don't want that to get lost in the mix. My quick take on all those.
I forgot about Portman.
I think Portman would work better than Cotillard would work.
Yeah.
None of them would work as good as Sandra Bullock does.
I don't think anyone is as good as her. It's just her age, with no disrespect. That's why I think Cotillard works better than Portman or any of the other names that are on this list, is because there's something about her being just that little bit older and being a mom and being really accomplished and know her shit, but also, you know, have all that trauma. Like, she sells that so effortlessly.
Isn't it wild that she auditioned? I'm presuming auditioned. I don't know if up for it means like maybe she was approached or whatever, but maybe she didn't audition. But isn't it wild that Portman was in contention, let's say, for the role, and then she just goes and does that other movie?
Black Swan. Black Swan.
No. Later.
Oh, Lucy
Lucy in the Sky. Like, yeah. That's because she did go and do Black Swan, and she's like, I got my Oscar, but I still haven't really done a space movie, so
right.
I gotta go and do that.
I want to be a psychotic astronaut. Let's go.
It's funny because it's just the Cotillard reminds me of Clooney in one of these, like, I can't even remember. It was one of these, like, Vanity Fair, whatever, talking about favorite performances or something. He mentions Marion Cotillard in La Vie en Rose, which she won the Oscar for. And he has a great, I always think about this, he has a great explanation of why he loves her performance, because in that movie, if you don't know, she plays Edith Piaf, the famous singer. And
one of the best actress wins ever.
Exactly. Yeah. And he says something so great, which is like, the reason that performance is so great is because she's playing an old woman, right? And she's young, but it's not that. It's that she plays the old woman wanting to be young.
Yes.
So, like, she's old, but she's not playing it old.
Yes.
Because Edith Piaf wanted to be young.
Yes.
And yeah. it's like that extra step, right?
Yeah.
Sure.
That's yeah. where the greatness is, right? Yeah. Is what he's saying. And I always, that's such a great actor's answer, right? Where it's like, you know, everybody has their craft, right? It's like, yeah. so, and I love that. You know, I love shit like actors loving their stuff. Like Ben Affleck being like, I finally figured out Batman in The Flash. And then yeah. you like watch The Flash and it's like really not on screen, you know, but it's like, I'm sure he's right. Right. But like, yeah. mm-hmm. he has no control over what makes it or doesn't make it or how it connects with the rest of the movie. And it's like the great curse of being an actor, right? Is that you give what you give on the day, but you have no, I mean, unless you're producing, yeah. unless you're Warren Beatty or something, you know, you have no, you know, unless you're Ben Affleck directing a Ben Affleck movie, but in that case, that's not the case. But like a lot of that doesn't make it, right? So it's like your arc often can be your own and yes. not anybody else's, which is interesting, you know. But. Sorry, oh, and really quick, Charcoal Joe is one of the last Walter Mosley Easy Rollins book.
Okay.
And it looks very makeable for a 65-year-old.
Let's do it. Let's get it.
Carl. So if you're listening, Carl Franklin
and Denzel,
or, you know, or both, Denzel or Walter
both
Mosley.
Both patrons everybody. Of both podcasts, really happy.
Oh, thank well, that's
you.
Good to know.
Thanks for
good.
Your patronage. Yeah. Huge patrons of B-Side and One Heat Minute. Just want to say thank you, Carl Franklin and Denzel, for your patronage.
Yeah, Denzel's just, we don't even have a big, Denzel just Venmos us. Every
yeah,
two
I, get
weeks,
a,
just,
I get a Venmo. It's
it just is Denzel. $5.
Yeah, yeah.
Good episode.
It. I really
occasionally
hope that
he
someone
just puts
listening,
the boom gif in there.
I really hope that someone finds your Venmo and sends you $5.
It's a Venmo that says Denzel. I know it's a Venmo that says I also liked making Ricochet $5.
Blake, if we ever hang out again in the future, that's what I'm gonna do if I owe you money for drinks or something.
It's just, that's a great idea.
That's really good.
It's all gonna be from Denzel Washington.
And it's just you talking about your previous projects. Loved making.
I wish more people had seen Antoine Fisher, $6.
Hey, Blake, thanks for seeing Journal for Jordan.
Oh,
$5, right? Like, whatever.
Oh, God. Well, look, we can't go longer than this movie. This podcast
cannot be longer than this movie.
We're going to wrap it up. Connor O'Donnell, Dan Mecca, always so much fun talking to you. And if there's anything that I hope out of any of these decade projects, that people go back and check out these films, because I've been kind of using the people that I'm talking to, sometimes I suggest the movie, sometimes I'm like, what's your favorite movie of 2013? And honestly, I would say that at the time, this absolutely was right up there as my favorite movie of 2013. I adored sure. it.
I would agree. Yeah.
I think I saw Her in January of 14, which actually is a 2013 movie, which I believe would be like, if I reflected back on those years, you know, that, you know, I adore that movie. But I would say that this, if it wasn't my number one, it was very, very close. And I just think it's a special movie, and Cuarón's a special filmmaker. And with such a short resume, he has such an incredible, incredible filmmaking acumen and storytelling acumen. And this movie just rules top to bottom. And I don't know if Clooney's been better in many years in a supporting role. I don't know if Bullock has been better since this.
I don't think she's ever been.
This is probably my favorite performance of hers.
And then The Blind Side wins the Oscar, and you're like, what?
Well,
we're gonna remember it for this.
It's Jodie Foster winning for The Accused, and then making Silence of the Lambs. You don't know she's gonna make Gravity, right?
Right.
You know, it's like if you knew that she was gonna make Silence, you wouldn't have given her the Oscar for The Accused, right? Yeah. You know, and Sigourney Weaver would have a fucking Oscar. You know, it's like, but you don't know that. You know, it's like, so it's hard.
But they still look and go, Jamie Lee Curtis hasn't got an Oscar, and Angela Bassett doesn't have an Oscar. We've just got to toss.
Don't
toss
talk to me about Angela. Still, even though she's getting an honorary one, which is nice, but
I mean, look,
Her, you know, it's funny. All right. her, are you going to do her? Because it doesn't apply at all anymore at all. It's totally doesn't apply at all to our world now.
Her. No, definitely has no relevance. I absolutely am doing her. I don't know when
it hasn't aged. It hasn't aged well at all.
No, or, wait, no. Yeah.
The perfect movie.
It's actually the perfect movie. And maybe
I got to rewatch that movie. I like think about that. Cause I really didn't love that movie when it came out. And I think about it. I'm like,
I think man, I about
bet that
one,
would hit me like a ton of bricks. If
I think
now,
about yeah. one line from that movie.
I bet I know what it is.
Several times a day.
But go ahead and you say it.
And it's the Amy Adams line where she's just like, I've decided I have to just allow myself joy. Mm. And it's like, I think about that all the time.
There you go.
Well, thank you for allowing me the joy of talking to you lads about Gravity. Really special one. You guys are the best. Can you plug the shit out of everything that you guys are doing? I don't know if you can announce our other little cheeky, beautiful summer project that you guys.
I think you can actually as of yesterday. Yeah, you can. So
sure, yes.
Yeah, so announce what you guys are doing, and then you can shout out.
Cinephile Summer, baby.
Yeah. So first up, obviously, Dan and I have a podcast called The B Side. You can check us out wherever you listen to podcasts. You can follow us on Twitter.
Is that your little car?
Is that your little car?
Blake has been honestly one of our favorite recurring guests. Most recently, Blake was on a Russell Crowe episode that we mentioned. We also did a Alan J. Pakula episode with Blake. So if you're a listener of this
consenting
podcast,
consenting adults got wild.
Oh God, I forgot.
So you can use Blake adults. As you can use Blake as an entry point, but we basically talk about movie stars and directors and not the movies that made them famous, but like other in between ones.
Oh, and an absolute wild chat with Richard Dreyfuss. A wild yes. chat.
Yeah, has to be listened after, to be.
I listened to after we recorded our Russell Crowe one, and I was like,
can I tell you what I love about the Richard Dreyfuss thing is that he proceeded to go on one of the most chaotic press tours you could ever go on. Where
it was the best.
We really snuck right in there.
He then proceeded to go on like Bill Maher's podcast and say some crazy shit, like four news shows and say crazier shit. And like the fact that he came on our little show like a week before all that, I like laugh every time. Yeah. I'm like, Rich just went out there and was like, let me just get a little
look in a vacuum. His appearance on our show was really nice.
It was
a wild combo for cinephiles, and it was like, great. And then you see his other stuff, and you're like, actually super tame. It was fine.
Yo,
it was
super, totally super, super tame.
Super normal.
But yeah, and then other than that, Dan has a wonderful short story podcast called yes. Fathom yes, Stories. Right, you should check that out. And then what Blake just alluded to, we are bringing back Cinephile Game Night in the form of now an audio video podcast over the course of the summer. As of this recording, the first episode just dropped. We are joined by our friends at the Letterboxd Show. So you can check that out either on Spotify or YouTube if you want to check out the video version, or on the Film Stage Show feed wherever you get your
podcasts. And the One Heat Minute Gang's coming up soon.
Yes. Yeah, so that'll be our next episode, will be a wonderful experience with One Heat Minute that I was sadly not there for, but it was
a lot of fun. We missed you terribly. And Dan absolutely smashed me.
I was going to say, big shoes to fill.
Dan smashed me in that show, guys. You'll see it. He threw me under the bus so hard on filmography. On movie actor. He absolutely killed me with John Leguizamo as the Pest.
Which is funny because that also
keeps coming up on
that also
shows.
Happens on the first episode. So it really
keeps coming up. No. You know what's funny? And Connor, correct me because you edited it. No, didn't I get out on the Pest in the first episode?
No, I got our guest Chandler.
Okay.
Spoilers, I guess, if you haven't listened to it.
Really, it's really, so really fun funny. Episode. The One Heat Minute Gang was so great because I love you guys so much and the whole team of Cinephile and Film Stage. And so, but the One Heat Minute Gang was all there. Maria Lewis, Alexi Toliopoulos, and Katie Walsh. Oh, it was like my dream lineup of friends to be there. If you watch the video, I'm fucking smiling like an idiot because I'm so happy. I'm just like all of my.
It's like a birthday party where you invite two different groups of friends.
It's the best. And they're all like talking shit and having the best time. I was like, this is fucking great. So yeah, it was an excellent.
It really was a great
It was such a fun time. I walked out of there like beaming. And my, you know, my wife does thing, you know, great partners do. Always like, oh, how was that? Or, you know, whatever. And I was like, that. I just like named the lineup. I was like, the film stage guys, you know, I love. And I was like, and Lex and Maz and Katie. And especially all of us Australians, it's like early in the morning. So Maz and Lexi are barely awake and it's just the best. And I had the best time. So thank you guys. You guys rule. This has been the Decade Project. And I'm, you know, we might find another movie to talk about, another 2013 movie to talk about, because I love talking to you guys about anything. But also I will tease, we're finally locked in the first scheduled recordings. For the folks who are listening on Patreon, know a little bit more about it than others. But when this eventually drops into the main feed, check out Midnight Run Through. It probably will be available by the time this is in the main feed of the show. Midnight Run Through is Jen Johans and I collaborating on a deep dive into Midnight Run. We're doing it with our own dynamic duos as Grodin and De Niro are. So we have Connor and Dan as one of our duos, which is super exciting. We've got a bunch of others that are coming up, and that's going to be a fun one. And then I got to decide what the hell else I'm going to do. What am I going to do after I finish that, guys? What am I going to do after I finish Podcaster and Commander? Who knows? I think I'll find something else to talk about.
Ferrari, baby. Ferrari.
Oh, God.
Yeah, I'm still pushing for Catrari, which is me getting Katie Walsh to the Venice Film Festival to watch Ferrari, the premiere. I really want to see Katie Walsh get
when it comes out, you got to call it. It's going to be something colon Ferrari. But just to keep it in the naming convention, you got to call it Revs Per Minute.
Revs and per minute.
Colin Ferrari.
Ferrari. And yeah, look, see, this is why you are friends with other podcasters and producers, because they're just dropping fire all the time, dropping fire. All right, lads, this has been great. You're the best. Take care. Thank you so much.
Thank you, sir.
Thank you.
And it feels like such a 20th century movie. It feels like something David Lean would have done or tried to do when he still had that kind of currency. And even then, he might not have succeeded.
It's incredible because, like, if you don't have time to watch all five seasons of Lost, you can just watch Fearless.
Not a week goes by that I don't think of the ending of Gallipoli. It's left a mark. A Year of Living Dangerously. You know, and then something like Last Wave, even, that's so deeply embedded with the land and the story of the land, the story of place. You know, I don't know that I'd seen very many movies at that point in my life that had such a down ending, and they had such a, you know, sort of strong sense of folklore attached to it as that. And something always so poetic and lyrical about Peter Weir's work.
Gallipoli was the first movie that ever traumatized me, and I don't think I ever really recovered from it. And I'm still upset that they played it in school. Like, I don't think it's actually possible to make an... They say it's not possible to make an anti-war movie, but I think Peter Weir pulled it off.
Yes.
Because no one watches that movie then thinks, I want to go to war.
Peter Weir is the greatest director that Australia has ever produced. Like, bar none, hands down. Like, no one else is even in the room.
I think you have covered some really titanic filmmakers and some really titanic films so far, but I truly think what makes Peter Weir special and what makes you doing this one special is we don't talk about Peter Weir that way, and we should. Peter Weir is one of those guys who I don't get why he isn't a bigger name, why he isn't more in that rarefied air.
Yes.
Because I think film for film, he's one of our very best filmmakers. He has brought his A game repeatedly to many properties. There are films of his that I hold very dear. Fearless, The Mosquito Coast. I will fight somebody if they talk bad about The Mosquito Coast. It's, man, I love that movie. But in general, I just think he is a special filmmaker, a smart, lyrical, hallucinatory filmmaker. He's a very dreamy filmmaker, and I don't think he gets his due.
You know, Master and Commander is one of my all-time favorite movies. You know, it's easily one of the best movies of the last 20 years. It's, it's a grand scale. There's a historical backdrop to it, but at the same time, there's such an intimacy in the relationships.
Which I think is not just a great film and one of the last great epics in the truest sense. I think is actually kind of a sliding doors change point moment in cinema history. I think 2003, when that comes along, and it is a an old-fashioned, you know, we don't make them like that anymore type film. I think if Master and Commander spawns a franchise at that point, the entire cinema landscape globally is completely different.
That's the movie that I wanted to see 10 of those, you know. And yeah, I know they're big fans of Fast and Furious and everything, and God bless you, but Master and Commander should have been.
It's one of those things. Again, I am not I'm not a seafaring man, sir. But there is a sense of authenticity. There's a sense of really watching a genuine dedication to recreating history unfold on a big screen in front of you that can't help but inspire just genuine admiration and awe.
If you're going to pick a film where he really brings every one of his skills to the table, it's Master and Commander. I think you picked the right one, man.
Yeah, very excited to see what you pull out of this, Blake.
That's right. Our next series is Peter Weir and Russell Crowe's Master and Commander. The series is called Podcaster and Commander.